Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, if you find yourself checking your phone a lot or feeling phantom vibrations, there's a good reason. Big technology companies, Google, Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, to name a few, want your attention. They want to know what you're thinking about, what you're doing, and what you're likely to do next. Author Franklin Foer came to Seattle at the dawn of the digital age to work for Slate magazine. He's back now with some serious warnings about what that age has wrought. If you're concerned about your personal freedom and privacy in a time when a small group of companies enjoy vast and growing control over your data and decision-making, buckle up for a thought-provoking and challenging talk. Franklin Foer is a staff writer at The Atlantic and former editor of The New Republic. His latest book is World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 27th. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Elliott Bay's Tony Mano introduces the event.
Thank you all for being here tonight at the Elliott Bay Book Company. Tonight we are very pleased to be joined by Franklin Foer, who is here tonight to discuss his new book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, which was just released this month by Penguin Press. The story of tech that Franklin unfolds in this book extends further back than Apple or Microsoft or Amazon. Back to the philosophy of the Enlightenment, to the printing press, to yellow journalism coming from the 19th century, and to the purveyors of a West Coast utopian thinking epitomized by the communes of the 60s. These set the cultural groundwork for our current age of technology, an age of worldwide interconnectedness and new opportunities to express ourselves as individuals. Meanwhile, a reevaluation of antitrust law and our collective redefinition of what constitutes a monopoly has given only a few tech companies almost complete reign over this quasi-utopian dream. World Without Mind chronicles the lead up to this new way of life, as well as the threat that this concentration of power holds for us today, much of which may come as no surprise to Seattleites. Franklin is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a fellow at the New America Foundation, as well as a recipient of the National Jewish Book Award. He is also the former editor of The New Republic, an experience that is at least partially chronicled in this new book. His book, How Soccer Explains the World, was a national bestseller. After Franklin's presentation, we'll open up the floor for some questions, and books will be available for sale in the back and for signing as well. So without further ado, please welcome Franklin Foer.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be in Seattle because Seattle is in some ways the starting point for this book, for me at least, because my first job out of college was working for Microsoft. More specifically, my first job out of college was working for Slate, which was the first internet magazine, if not the first, it was the most hyped of the early internet magazines, because Michael Kinsley, who'd been the editor of The New Republic, which is also part of the saga, came out to Seattle. And there was a goofy picture of him on the cover of Newsweek wearing a yellow rain slicker and a yellow hat holding up a fish about how Seattle was the next hot city. And when so when I came out here, Slate was like in week two of its existence. And Microsoft had created an entirely separate campus to house its nascent media empire. And so the Red West campus at Microsoft was filled with all of these magazines that Microsoft had created. There was a woman's magazine called Underwire, which, yeah, perhaps explains why that was a doomed venture. There was an automobile magazine. They were going to try to kill the Stranger in Seattle Weekly and all the other alt weeklies by creating something called Sidewalk. Slate, of course, survived, but all the other ones met untimely deaths. And we'll get back to that in a minute, because that also tells us a little bit something about this story. But I've got a very apocalyptic thesis, at least that's the way that it's been characterized, which I suppose is only fair if you call your book World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. But rather than bludgeon you over the head with my thesis, I'll bludgeon you in a bit. I'm going to digress my way to the thesis of the book by just telling you, just picking up the thread of the narrative of my own personal story and trying to use that a little bit as a parable for what I'm talking about. So after I was with Slate, I went to work for a magazine called The New Republic, which was this little magazine. It had at its height 100,000 readers. It was this weird alchemy of insider political reporting, high-minded, often contrarian pieces about political ideas, and very long cultural essays about highbrow things. And it was the type of thing that you would never invent again, but it was just like a weird, it was a historical amalgamation that existed and found a very cult-like readership. In fact, I read a history of the 1960s once, which described, it was trying to explain how small a sect American liberals actually are. And it said you could fit the readers of the New Republic into the University of Mississippi football stadium, and there would still be room. So it was this quirky magazine that prided itself on being original, and maybe sometimes it was too original in its ideas. And I was working there, and I became editor of the magazine in 2006. And it was a really hard time to be the editor of any media outlet because media was being convulsed. You ultimately had two recessions, the one in 2000 and the one in 2008. That crushed the advertising market, and the disappearance of the advertising market remade American journalism. There were hundreds of thousands of jobs lost in American journalism. And I think you know this in Seattle, where you've seen various arms of your local media atrophy over the course of the last couple decades. And so how to navigate this new world. I really, really struggled with it because we wrote opinion and suddenly there were blogs and everybody had an opinion and everybody had a microphone to express their opinion. And so the question was, how much do we play in this new world? And we just struggled. And we kept having to find new benefactors for the magazine. And so I was always going up to New York to try to hoodwink investment bankers into believing that they could actually make a profit on this magazine, when in my heart of my hearts I knew that that was really not possible. And so I got exhausted by this process of searching for new owners and trying to figure out how to master the internet. And I went back to writing. And then in 2012, it was this mystical savior entered, a guy called Chris Hughes. Chris had been Mark Zuckerberg's roommate at Harvard. And he had been he co-founded Facebook. He was one of its first employees, and he became fantastically wealthy at a very young age. And so this 28-year-old guy walked into the New Republic and said, "I have deep pockets. I'm committed to serious journalism, and I can help you figure out this new world because I invented social media." And it was dreamy. From my perspective, I couldn't believe my good luck. And I came back to the New Republic to edit and work with Chris. And we were going to try to find some sort of dignified way to try to solve all the problems that ailed journalism. And it started off kind of beautifully, where we did very exhilarating things. Like we tried to figure out how to create an anti-website, because if you read the web, one of the things that happens on any website is you keep scrolling down, 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 down. There's an infinite number of things for you to read. And we thought, let's just impose the values of a magazine on the web, where there's hierarchy and finitude and a clear sense if you go to a web page of this is the most important thing, and we're going to make sure that you read the most important thing. And it was really fun to think like this, but it was totally ineffectual. And so Chris kind of had this dream that we would present this new idea and people would instantly flock to it. And that's not the way that the world works, unfortunately. And so we were publishing great journalism because I had huge resources. And so in 2000, 13, I could send somebody to Burma to write about the Rohingya. And it just felt like a privilege to be able to do something like that, to really, I was living the dream. I was committing resources to projects that seemed important and giving writers time and space to write with style and flair. And there was, craftsmanship was the ideal. I felt like it was like a Brooklyn cheese shop or maybe a Pike Street burrito stand or something where I was doing it the artisanal way, which was really great. But then the inevitable happened, which is Chris said, we're spending too much money. We need to produce revenue. And the way to produce revenue is to grow web traffic. The way to grow web traffic in a very quick sort of way is to produce writing, produce content, to use the term of art, that will flourish on Facebook. And luckily, he invented Facebook, so he said, I know the tricks. And you start off in this sort of process saying, okay, we can do this in a way that doesn't really damage our soul. But let me tell you. And so we started. And the thing that he wanted us to produce was what he called snackable content. All right, it's admittedly a horrible term and admittedly kind of a horrible concept. But the idea was that when you're sitting on a subway platform and you're looking at your phone and you just want to decompress, you want the kind of the journalistic equivalent of Doritos that you can kind of just munch on and decompress. And so how do you do this? Well, first of all, he said, look, everybody is doing this. You shouldn't feel bad about doing this. All the cool kids are doing it. The Washington Post is doing it. Time Magazine is doing it. And what it involved was, first of all, you had to explore the data. So I had always paid a little bit of attention to how many issues a magazine sold on the newsstand. I'd always had access to the web traffic, but this becomes an obsession because the goal is so immediate. You have to produce traffic, and that's a daily struggle. It's an hourly struggle or a minute-to-minute struggle. And there's a device that I had called Chartbeat, and this exists in every newsroom in America. If you walk into the Washington Post, for instance, there are big screens sitting up in the newsroom that shows the popularity of any article at any given moment, that shows how it's performing on Facebook. And so I had on my phone this Chartbeat app, and it was a flickering needle showing me, you know, whether I was succeeding or failing at any given moment. And it became an all-consuming thing for me because, first of all, the health of the enterprise depended on us producing traffic. But also, I'm a human being, and if you show me that this device that shows that I'm winning or losing at any given moment, I'm gonna want to be winning. And I wasn't popular in high school. I had a chance now suddenly to be popular all the time. And so it was addictive. I'll get to the broader subject of addiction in a moment because I guarantee all of you suffer from it when it comes to technology. But for me, I would wake up in the morning, I would see how we were performing on Facebook, then I would check it again as I went downstairs to get coffee, and it was almost a biological response. I was stuck in this feedback loop of I knew what was working, what wasn't working, I wanted to produce what was working, and I would argue that this is happening into the entire world of journalism, and in some respects, it's happening to the world writ large. And so in journalism, all of journalism is hugely dependent on two monopolies, Google and Facebook, for their financial health. And so everybody's playing the same sort of game. What happens? Well, if you want to be popular, everybody rushes to the same popular subjects. So if you look at Facebook or you look at Twitter, you see what's trending. You see what's on the upward ascent to becoming popular. And there's a whole variety of tools that you have at your disposal to understand the data, to understand the mind of the internet, so you can tap into it. One of these tools is called CrowdTangle, which you know, when you step back and you think about a lot of these things, they sound kind of cute and cuddly, but then you're like, man, that is ominous. CrowdTangle. I'm getting tangled up in the crowd as I produce these things. And there's one anecdote I have in the book about just that highlights the ways in which this race for popularity creates homogenization. It creates this convergence. There was, I don't know if you remember, a couple years ago, there was a celebrity lion called Cecil, who was killed by a Minnesota hunter. And this Minnesota hunter posted a picture of himself in front of his kill on Facebook, and the entire internet piled on to this guy. Maybe rightfully so. I mean, it's not an attractive thing. But on the other hand, is it the most important story in the world? Well, there were 3.2 million stories written about Cecil the Lion, according to the New York Times. And this is where I'm going to start to broaden out into my argument. I would argue to you that Donald Trump is Cecil the Lion. That Donald Trump was clickbait. Donald Trump was, at least at the beginning, he was somebody that everybody in journalism knew that you shouldn't take seriously. This guy's presidential campaign was treated as a joke phenomenon. You know, for the first couple times that he got into this, it was treated as a joke phenomenon when. But people kept giving him attention. When he talked about Obama's birth certificate time and again, he got on CNN, and not just Fox News. And then everybody, there was a response. Everybody in mainstream media was writing about this, even if they were criticizing Donald Trump for bringing up the birth certificate. They were giving him attention. They were giving him attention because he was traffic, because he was ratings, because he was Cecil the Lion. And so I really think that I got into the subject of monopoly and the problems of these tech companies from this experience. I saw, number one, the perils of dependence, that you have these big companies. And in my book, I write about four of them: Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. And in various ways, shapes, and forms, we're dependent on these companies. And when you become dependent on these companies, when they have the economic power that they have, they're able to thrust their values onto everybody who kind of lives and dies on the platform. They pick winners, they pick losers. And you have to play by their rules if you want to be a winner. And so this is an incredible problem for us when it comes to the functioning of markets, because Amazon and Google play a huge role in the way that markets operate. We saw this with Yelp as kind of the classic example of this, where once upon a time, if you typed in the name of a coffee shop or a restaurant or an ice cream parlor, the first thing that would come up into the result was Google, was Yelp. And so you'd use Yelp reviews, and Yelp built a business around this. And then Google said, well, damn, that's a good business. We should get in this business. It's so easy to do. And so Google got in the business, and lo and behold, the first thing that came up in the search engine was no longer Yelp. It was Google. So these platforms act as if they're neutral. The idea of a search engine is that it's mechanistic. There's no human fingerprints on the search engine. It's all algorithms. It's all math. Which is somewhat true, but also completely phony, because algorithms are written by human beings. Human beings work for companies that have goals, and human beings also have biases that get brought to bear. And this is brought home to us constantly when we see these stories about the tech industry and the way that the tech industry apparently thinks about women, or that it the way that it thinks about diversity. And so they come from a specific place. And when they create the systems, like any system, it reflects the bias of the creator. So that was how I came to this issue, was because of my concerns about the questions of dependence. And as I got deeper and deeper into the subject, I started to study the sayings, the thoughts, the speeches that were given by the men who run these companies. So much of tech reporting, so much of tech journalism is about the latest product launch. It's about the new features on the iPhone. It's about whatever Google is giving out to its designers next. But really, when you listen to Larry Page or you listen to Mark Zuckerberg, to a much lesser extent, if you listen to Jeff Bezos, they say incredible things. They talk about human nature. They talk about civilization. They talk about our future as human beings. And they have a really strong point of view. And it's you don't have to be conspiratorial to kind of see that the tech companies are trying to lead us to a new and what they perceive to be better place. You just have to read what these guys write. And so I sat and I watched their YouTube footage of them endlessly. And what I discovered as I had a revelation as I was watching them. And the revelation was that we think about Silicon Valley, we think about tech as being dominated by libertarians. And it is true, there are a lot of libertarians who run tech companies. But when I listened to them talk about the world, I came to the conclusion that they were almost the opposite of libertarians. They aspired for the world to get brought together in one, for everything to be joined together into perfect systems. It's everything is crowdsourced. It's social media. It's not individual media. It's everything is about collaboration. And most importantly, it's about the network. They fetishize the network. Everything is collectivist. It's all about us getting stuck together into a hive mind, really. I mean, that's kind of their Platonic ideal, is that there's going to be the wisdom of the crowds. And there's some similarities to libertarian thinking in it. But libertarians are supposed to be sensitive. I'm not a libertarian, but libertarians are supposed to be sensitive to individuals and individuality. But these companies are the opposite. They have no sensitivity to individuals and individuality. And we can see this in every aspect of their existence, nearly, that they're rolling privacy. They have so little concern for privacy, which is the basis for our individuality. They don't really care about the idea of individual authorship, which is a really important concept. That if I write words, they're my property. They belong to me, and because they need to have integrity that I can protect. But they want words to be kind of mashed up and cut up and open to anyone to kind of buy and sell, or not buy and sell, but to do whatever they want with. And they have their own business reasons for that to be the case. They think that monopoly is the Platonic ideal of capitalism. They don't understand the importance of having competitive markets, of the dangers of having private power so concentrated in so few pockets. When it comes to the whole question of free will, which is the very core of what it means to be an individual, they want us to increasingly make choices on the basis of algorithms, which is to say, they don't want us to make choices at all. They want us to be liberated from the process of making choice. And some of this is innocuous. And so we need to say at the outset that the technologies that these guys have created are some of the most amazing examples of human creativity and human ingenuity that the world has ever seen. Google is a phenomenal creation of human beings, that you can type in any query and get an answer of some sort in milliseconds. They managed to organize knowledge in a way that nobody's ever done before. The iPhone is a wonder of engineering. But just because they've created magical devices doesn't mean that we should treat them in a magical sort of way. We need to apply the same skepticism to these devices and these companies that we apply to every other human endeavor. And we need to treat them with skepticism. There needs to be a process of creating countervailing powers so that Nobody has the run of the field. I think we also just need to understand precisely what we're dealing with. So let's just talk about the question of addiction, which is a question that it's so obvious when we deal with these devices. And in a way, its obviousness prevented me from going there first in my exploration of this topic, but really I've come to see that it's almost everything. So when it comes to our phones, I shudder to think at how many times I check my phone over the course of the day. Of course, there are apps that you can use to measure that, but I'd rather not have that data. Actually, it probably would be very good for me to have that data, because maybe it would scare the crap out of me enough that I would throw my phone into Puget Sound. So we're all addicted to it, and it's almost physiological, the way that we're addicted to it. So if our phone is in the other room, we start to feel anxious. We need it attached to our sides. I bet a lot of people in this room sleep with their phones. Not like that. you're sick if that's what you're doing. Well, actually, I guess pornography, phones, it probably. I never told that joke before, and it's not that good. But now I'm suddenly embarrassed that I went there. But the other thing is that this is a phenomenon I learned about yesterday. There's a guy I met when I was just in San Francisco for the book tour. I met a guy called Tristan Harris, who had a startup called Aperture, and his company got bought by Google, and he worked for Google, and he came something like Google's ethicist in chief, I think was his title. And then eventually, he was so horrified by what he saw Google was doing in terms of just perpetrating addiction, he ended up leaving and starting an organization called Time Well Spent, which is trying to help people cope with their addictions to technology. And so one of the things that he told me is, you know about the phantom buzz. And I was like, oh my God, I totally know about the phantom buzz, which is that you have this sensation that your phone is buzzing, that there's a notification that's happening, and it isn't actually there, because the phone just kind of is meant to elicit these kinds of anxious, neurotic responses. What he points out and what I point out in the book is that if you look at a lot of this, let's talk about Facebook again. Facebook is addicting you by design. This is not just because they've created something that's so awesome you can't live without it. What Facebook has done is, and all these companies have done, but we're talking about Facebook. Facebook has amassed a portrait of the inside of your mind. They've followed you everywhere. You don't even know where they followed you, because they've watched everything that you've read. Every page, when they created the like button, one of the reasons that they created it is that every person who had a website would stick a like button on their page in order to drive up their Facebook traffic. But that like button became a way of tracking you. They could follow how you were behaving on each page that had a like button. Facebook takes this information, and they're even aggregating it with your behavior offline. They know they know about your purchases in stores because they're able to take that information from elsewhere and combine it together. And the sum total of this is really profound. They know your habits. Eric Schmidt, who is the chairman of Google, said within 24, they can predict with a fairly high degree of certainty where you'll be 24 hours from now. Privacy is something that we kind of consider in the abstract, but we really never consider in the particulars. And our failure to appreciate that, I think, is going to come back to bite us in the tuchus. I read an article this morning in The Guardian by a woman who, with the help of some EU lawyers, was able to use EU privacy laws to get her data from Tinder, which is the dating hookup app. And she said it was 800 pages of data that had every message that she'd sent to a prospective date. It had everything that she'd liked on Facebook, and so on and so forth. And it filled her with an incredible sense of shame, because the things that we do online, the questions that we ask of Google, are things that we never expect anybody else to know. The text messages that we send to a friend are things that we never expect will escape into the public sphere. The times that we look at, you know, do you want to know how many times your spouse has looked at their ex-boyfriend's Facebook page? they're secrets. We're confiding in these machines, oftentimes in ways that we would never confide in a human being, because our expectation is that nobody will ever know. So Facebook takes all of your secrets, they take all of your habits, and they use it to try to keep you engaged on their site for as long as possible. Let me just explain something about Facebook. So Facebook is a giant feedback loop. Facebook is trying to give you exactly what you want, oftentimes, in order to keep you coming back. Facebook is elevating information with its algorithms that is designed to play to your anxieties, because they found that making you anxious is one of the best ways to keep you coming back to their site. So, like, if you looked at my Facebook page, you would see that my Facebook newsfeed, you would see there was a lot of articles about parenting and about how you're doing a crap job of raising your child, and I think that's generally the case. Or let's go to the realm of politics, where I think that this is the most disturbing. We live in very, very polarized times. So it's hard to see the ways in which Facebook is increasing conformity in the world. But we live in what's been called filter bubbles. So if you're a liberal, you're getting essentially liberal news thrown at you. If you're a right winger, you're getting right wing news thrown at you constantly. You're not getting stuff from the other side, and sometimes you're not even getting the neutral stuff in the middle. You're getting the things that tell you exactly what you want to hear, and I can't overemphasize the degree to which that's dangerous. It's dangerous because when you're hearing what you want to hear all the time, you become inured to conspiracy theory. You become inured to fake news. You become inured to propaganda. You become highly susceptible to demagogic appeals. And I don't even think I need to point to you the object lessons that prove my case. And so right now, Facebook is coming under severe scrutiny because the way that their system operates is coming into full view. It's a world in which they took zero moral responsibility for the information that flowed to the people who use Facebook, and there's an incredible percentage of Americans who rely on Facebook as their primary source of news and information. So that's part of the story. I try to tell the story in a way to explain the history of it all, the way in which when the introduction kind of captured some of this, the ways in which a lot of our ideals about technology grow from our ideals for human civilization. There's some really noble and profound sentiments at the core of our technology. One of the interesting accidents of Silicon Valley is that Silicon Valley is the mid part of the San Francisco Peninsula. And in the 1960s, you had the Grateful Dead and you had LSD. At the same time, you had Apple and the development of the personal computer and the invention of the internet. And in the late 1960s, you had hundreds of thousands of Americans going out to communes. You especially had that in Northern California. And the ideal of the commune is incredibly beautiful. It's this idea that we could create these utopian communities where we would interact with one another and interact with the land differently. And so there was a guy called Stuart Brand who created something called the Whole Earth Catalog, which his idea was that he would sell tools to the people who lived in the communes, and that tools were actually essential to making the communes work. And the Whole Earth Catalog was fantastically successful. It was one of the shock publishing phenomenons of the late 60s, early 70s. And Brand helped conceptualize some of the ideology of the communes that then became the ideology of the technology industry. Steve Jobs called the Whole Earth Catalog the Bible of his generation. And the idea was that, you know, technology is what ails the world, and we need new technologies to help liberate us from the old technologies. And in that time, you had IBM represented the computer, and the computer was this big oppressive box. It was in order to use the computer, you had to use punch cards. You had to go up to a window where there were guys with skinny ties and white jackets who processed your punch cards, and the computer was highly connected to the military industrial complex. And so there was this idea that we could get rid of that old oppressive idea of technology with new technologies. And Brand actually was the guy who came up with the idea of the personal computer. He didn't invent the personal computer, but he saw what was happening in the labs in Silicon Valley, and he said, oh, this is what's happening. We're taking technology. The computer is going from being this implement of bureaucratic monopolies and armies to becoming this tool of personal liberation. And he looked at what was happening with video games, and he said, oh, man, these guys are achieving a new state of consciousness. It's kind of like what was happening to my groovy comrades over in the communes. And so I tell this story because our hopes for technology are just so profound. We expect so much of it. But we don't realize is that the network was the idea of the commune, that you would connect everybody together in the world through technology. And again, a beautiful, beautiful concept, but it was also the basis for the biggest business opportunity in humankind. And so the idea of a network we're all tied together and we're all connected and we're all achieving a state of global consciousness is great when it's a utopian thing done by a bunch of hippies. But when big firms capture the network and control the network, it becomes the basis for monopoly. There's no second place in the network. That's the theory in Silicon Valley. That once one firm captures the network, everybody else should just pack it in, and because there's no way that you can compete with that first player. So I'm just gonna finish my spiel, and then I'll turn this open to questions. And I just want to finish my spiel by talking about the idea of determinism. That in some ways, when we think about technology, we think about the trajectory of everything. We say, all right, well, you know, maybe privacy is not going to survive, but there's nothing that I as an individual can do about it. Well, maybe technology is going to destroy institutions, and there's really nothing that I can do about it. So I look at all the books on the wall here, and I actually see a sign of hope that when Amazon introduced the Kindle in 2008, I think it was, there were all these predictions that paper books were doomed. Like, who would want these books when you could get every volume in the world in a flash on any device that you were looking for? It would save clutter. It's just the most incredible convenience. It would be profoundly cheaper than these books on the wall. But lo and behold, what happened? We didn't roll with that. We didn't accept that as our fate. And as all these predictions that these books would disappear, well, ebook sales have plateaued and actually started to decline, and paper book sales inch up a little bit every year. Why is this the case? Well, we can credit the publishing industry. The publishing industry, unlike media, said we're not gonna let the economic value of our product get degraded. And so they went to war with Amazon over the price of a book. They didn't accept that information has to be free. Secondly, I think everyone in this room who still reads paper books has an instinct. It's subconscious, but I think it's real. And I tried to figure out for myself, why was it that I kept reading paper? Because when the Kindle came, I thought it was great. I was like, oh my, I love a bookstore more than anything, and I have a bookstore in my pocket now. This is incredible. But really, the mind, I live on screens all day long. You live on screens all day long. I think we understand as human beings that we can't be human fully if we're distracted constantly, if we're being notified, pinged and dinged constantly, if our attention is constantly being commandeered by people, that we know that in order to think, we need to decouple ourselves from the company store. We need to have a moment to be by ourselves. And books are the most profoundly private space. Where do we read books? Well, I read books in bed. I read books in the bathtub. You don't need to think about that image. I read books in when I'm kind of locked away in my office and I'm sitting in an easy chair and I'm not being distracted. That's the history of reading. Reading started out with priests who had technical knowledge. There were no spaces between words. Reading was an exceedingly complicated activity that had to almost be practiced aloud. Nobody read silently. But then over time, words started to have spaces between them. Everybody learned how to read more or less, and it changed humanity. We stopped being people who thought collectively and took dictates from the people who were reading to us. And when we started to read in our own corners, in our own spaces, we were able to formulate our own opinions. You're able to think subversively when you're with a book. You're able to, you know, who knows how the hell our mind works, but you know, when you're reading a book, your mind is lighting up and concentrating and in a translate state, and all these things are happening. But I think it's a moment when we're truly alive as human beings, and that becomes even more important now because we're trapped in these systems where it feels like you can't. You're out of control. But when you're with a book, you feel like you're in control. And to me, this is the metaphor, which is that the rise of something like Uber. We say, all right, this is a really great technology, but we're just going to let it. And we know maybe it does some terrible things, but we'll just let it run its course because who wants to get in the way of innovation? But then London steps in and London says, you know what? We don't like the way that you treat workers. We don't like that you're a lawless a company that disobeys the same set of rules that we make everybody else follows. And if you want to play ball here, if you want to drive your cars in London, you're going to have to behave in a way that's consonant with what we deem to be the common good. Mark Zuckerberg needs to be called to account for fake news, for Russian propaganda, for this system, this addictive system that he's created. We don't need to go all the way to breaking up his company, although that's something we might want to consider. But let's just have him testify before the Senate, because Mark Zuckerberg has never had to answer for his behavior. He exists in a world where he's an engineer who's created what he believes is the most perfect system. And so he doesn't necessarily see the ways in which his system might have beautiful internal logic, but might be sucky for human beings. I look at the take a knee protest this last week in the NFL, and you know, we sometimes feel so impotent and inert in the face of power or in the face of bullies or in the face of, and here was an example of collective action that happened almost spontaneously and in the most unlikely way, where even even owners, Trump supporting owners of NFL teams got sucked into it. I know that's different than what I'm talking about, but really it's the same, because these machines are both incredible, but they suck away our sense of agency. The way that technology has been conceived in this country is both beautiful and liberating, but also profoundly enslaving. And so we just need to, we're going into a future where a lot of profound changes are going to be happening to us as human beings. You know, as I said, these guys want to have us merge with machines. We've always had technology. We've always had tools. We've had hammers. We've had plows. But what's being automated right now isn't upper body strength. It's mental functions are being automated right now. And we wear technology on our wrists. We wear it on the bridge of our nose if it's Google Glass. These guys want to implant technology eventually inside of our bodies. And we're gonna be transformed as a species. And some of those transformations will be good. Some of them will be profoundly bad. But the point is that we can't afford to simply accept things as they come, because these changes are not happening in the public interest. They're happening in the interest of a handful of powerful corporations. And so as human beings, we need to be firm. We need to be thoughtful. We need to understand what it is we want to survive in these transformations, and what it is we're perfectly happy to give away. It's the really hard conversations to have, because the solutions are complicated and not apparent, and we're all addicted in ways in which we feel like we're trapped, we're human guinea pigs. We feel like human guinea pigs sometimes in a grand experiment that somebody is conducting on us. But if we're human guinea pigs, we're also human. And I think we need to stand up and reclaim the human. So why don't we, if people have questions, I'd be happy to take them. Yeah. So the question is, are there outlets for activism and resistance? I'm not just repeating you for the sake of repeating you. I'm doing it for the, yeah. right now, they're not, as far as I can tell, not really, because we're in the early stages. Our politics are being transformed in supremely interesting ways in the last couple months, because I'll admit this, it might not be popular in a Seattle crowd, but I actually went on Fox News to talk about, they had me on to talk about my book. We can't just kind of give up on the process of changing people's minds. That's a problem right now. That is the filter bubble problem, is where we stopped talking to one another. And they were really interested in the question of monopoly and the power of these tech companies. And they might not be coming at it for the best of reasons, but I looked back at the founding manifesto for the National Review magazine in the 1950s. And there was a paragraph that's the magazine that created American conservatism, William F. Buckley's magazine. There was no conservatism before National Review. And in that founding manifesto, there was a paragraph about the dangers of monopoly, because conservatives understand that concentrations of power can be dangerous when they come in the form of the state, and they can be dangerous when they come in the form of the corporation. And so it's going to divide the left. Barack Obama, for all of his greatness, was terrible on these issues. The company that went in the Oval Office more than any other in the Obama administration was Google. And when it came to basic questions, like should these companies pay their taxes, he took their side. Now, just on the question of taxes, which is, to me, just one of the most galling questions of them all, Amazon pays 13% effective tax. That's state, federal, municipal, and international. I have very little sympathy for Walmart, but Walmart pays 30% effective tax rate. So if Walmart is being disadvantaged against Amazon to that extent, you know, how is Elliott Bay Books being disadvantaged when it comes to competing against Amazon? And just consider the implications of that. They're basically plundering us, plundering the coffers of the state, taking advantage of us in order to build their monopolies. And then they say, bow down before us because we've created such incredible corporations. You know, but really, Amazon became powerful because they didn't pay state tax. That was one of their big tricks. And it became impossible for a lot of brick and mortar stores to compete against them. And I'm not just pontificating about this or pulling this out of thin air. There are studies by economists that document how that's the case. So I'm giving you just more reasons to be angry and less possibility of hope and solutions.
Like being angry is part of the solution at this stage.
I totally think so. I mean, it's so, you know, if this is not exactly the right comparison, but I mean, in order to do something about climate change, you first need to acknowledge the fact that the planet's climate is changing. And I think that broadly right now, our culture regards these companies as pretty fabulous. Maybe there's some elites who have problems with these companies, but if you do the polling, most people really like these guys.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Franklin Foer is a staff writer at The Atlantic and former editor of The New Republic. His latest book is World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 27th. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org. Tune in again soon.